A line in the opening paragraph of Faith Saley's new book, Approval Junkie, reads, "I'm wary of total self-acceptance. I'd rather fail dramatically than risk complacency." The subtitle of the book is Adventures in Caring Too Much, and over the course of the next couple hundred pages, Saley tells stories about her overachieving childhood, her failed marriage, the saving grace of public radio, and many other things she cares very much about, all building a case that seeking approval can actually be a good and healthy thing. You may know Faith Saley from her appearances on the panel of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or the PBS show Science Goes to the Movies. She joined host Lois Reitzes to talk about her book, her upbringing, and living the public radio dream.
What made you decide to write the book?
Oh, I had come to a point in my life. I just turned 41. I had just had my first baby, and I felt like I had all these really big questions answered. Questions like, will I ever be a mother? Will I find love again? I had been divorced. What am I supposed to be doing? Where is home? I felt like all those big questions had been answered, and I had room to think and breathe and express, and I felt like I'd somehow climbed to a top of one of life's mountains and had perspective. And I wanted to share some stories. And I looked at the stories I wanted to share, and I saw that there was this theme running through them of constantly seeking approval and a kind of evolving, I hope, relationship with how I seek approval and for what and from whom.
Well, at the outset, you state that this is not a self-help book.
No.
Why isn't it bad to care about approval?
Yeah, I don't want to be prescriptive. I think that my stories might have some implicit cautionary tales and I hope a lot of inspiration and entertainment. I think that seeking approval has largely served me well. Look, when I was a kid, seeking approval meant being quote-unquote a good girl, like, you know, not doing drugs, doing my homework, making straight A's, being nice to my parents and writing thank you notes. None of those things is a bad thing. And as you get older, if you seek approval, in my experience, seeking approval for reasons of like inspiring myself, trying to stretch myself, seeking approval from colleagues whom I admire, seeking approval from my second husband who inspires me, those things have never disserved me.
Well, then how do you distinguish a perfectionist from an approval junkie?
I think I'm not a perfectionist. I think a perfectionist is someone who's afraid to try certain things for fear of falling short, right? If you're a perfectionist, you want everything to be perfect. I think an approval junkie, at least the way I have been one or in my definition, is someone who so wants applause or laughter or to create something new or compelling that you're willing to take big risks and to embarrass yourself and to fail. And maybe even when you fall down, like, stand up and take a bow for trying.
One of the delights of the book is your wordplay. You just referred to your husband. That was the first of several words you create.
I do know I talk about camaraderie on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is just the great feel for any of your listeners who are Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me fans. Those with discerning ears, I'm sure, hear that some panels have more fun or create funnier shows than others. And I do feel like the comedy that comes from, you know, generous camaraderie as performers is the best to listen to. But thank you. Maybe I feel like my faith lexicon would be very short, but thank you for appreciating them.
You did not include genderalization.
Oh, that's right.
Psychonundrum. Jeez.
Oh, my gosh, I forgot about all of these. Right. I need to read my book again, Lois.
I highly recommend it. Well, would you elaborate on what it was like being a serious high school student who studied hard and wanted to go to an Ivy League school, but who also hoped to win the beauty pageant.
Welcome to Atlanta, right?
Yes.
I grew up in Atlanta in the 80s, and I went to a wonderful public high school called North Springs High School. It is still there. I believe now it's a charter school. And the highlight of my time at North Springs as a Spartan, as a North Springs Spartan, was my annual attempt to win the Miss Aphrodite beauty and talent pageant. I need not remind you, Lois, that that Aphrodite is the goddess of beauty and love. And there was this unwritten rule that only a senior could win, but that, you know, that did not keep me from trying every single year. I don't think we all have the time for me to go through what I wore and what I sang every year, but there was Liza Minnelli, there was some Barbara Streisand. I ended up hiring the local pageant coach. I mean, this woman, Valerie Kennedy, God bless if she's still there. She could turn anyone into Miss anything. And she taught me like a pageant arm raise. She helped me decide what to wear, which in the case of the year I won, everybody, spoiler alert, I won. Unfortunately, I lost 45 pounds my senior year of high school. That was part of my approval junkiness of you know, manifesting an eating disorder. All of that combined, I think, helped me win the Miss Aphrodite 1989 title, and I still have the tiara.
Of course. Well, of course. That chapter on your eating disorder was very mm-hmm. scary. Have you come to terms with your body image and your weight?
Yeah, I mean, I still work out every single day. I like how it makes me feel. I like feeling strong. I like feeling agile since I am 45 and have a 2-year-old and one who's about to turn 4. I need my muscles ready to go and spring into action. And I also like that working out gives me at least 45 minutes of a day that belongs completely to me. I don't like the fact that at my age, I am now in middle age, that if I don't get in a workout, I don't feel comfortable all day long. I wish I could liberate myself from that. But I will say, you know, it's hard to understand what a normal body is when you have been, you know, when you have been an adult who weighed under 100 pounds, right? Because after that, everything for a while feels like you're fat, even if you're healthy. Mm. I write about this in the book, and it's a cliche, but you know what? It's a cliche for a reason. I think that when you give birth to children, it's such a fundamentally life-changing experience that you have to, it alters the way you think about your body. And I am not proud to say that it really did take me 40 years to think about the proper way to respect my body. But when it came time that I was lucky enough to be able to produce and carry my own child, and I had to prioritize taking care of a baby inside me, that's when I really started respecting my body and started treating, like feeding myself healthful things because I was taking care of someone else. You know, it's sad that it took taking care of somebody else, but I got there. And now that I do not have children inside me, but outside me, I still think it's very important to, you know, demonstrate a healthy relationship with food and with my body. And God forbid my children ever hear me saying something derogatory towards my body in front of them. I don't want them to grow up with any, you know, body image issues.
Faith, you write lovingly about your mother and depict her with a whole lot of humor, to no surprise. Tell us about how she expressed herself through baking.
Oh, thank you for bringing up my mom. That was one of the deepest challenges of my book was trying. My mother died when I was 26, and she had just turned 53. She is buried in Atlanta. I couldn't tell my story, and especially my story of approval, because she always gave me approval, without talking about my mother. And yet it's so hard to try to paint a picture of someone so wonderful. She baked and cooked for us all the time. This was a lady who said the rosary while she did her sit-ups. You know, she was a master of micromanaging. And when we would drive down Spalding Drive on the way to school in Atlanta, there was, in the early 80s, there was like a chain gang of prisoners. Are there still chain gangs on the roads?
Yes, working the highways.
There are, prisoners. My mom would drive past them and she'd say, oh, I gotta get home to make them something. So she'd drop us off at school and she'd go home and she would bake them pumpkin bread and she'd bake them cranberry walnut bread and she'd drive the fresh loaves to the head of the work gang. And I don't know when she expected the prisoners ate it, but they loved her. I mean, they did not have necessarily discerning taste buds, but they were thrilled she was there. So they called her the gingerbread lady. And that was my growing up. That was my mother. That was what I saw. That was my image of what it meant to be generous and social and happy. My mother was always delivering baked goods to people, including these amazing gingerbread houses. And I was kind of her entropic sous chef. I don't know how helpful I was, but she let me, you know, beat crack eggs and measure things. And then when I got older, I didn't have any interest in being in the kitchen. I think that was part of Women's Studies 101 as a freshman, right? Like a room of one's own was not the kitchen. And then when she died, right after I left grad school, I am the only girl in our family, a daughter. And so I got her jewelry, and I got her recipes. And she was gone, and I had these recipes that were written on index cards. You know, some of them are from her tennis partners. And my mom had made handwritten notes on them, and she always added extra vanilla. And she graded the recipes. And I started baking. I wanted to be close to her, and I had moved across the country from where I grew up in Atlanta. I was living in LA, and I was alone, and there was something about baking in a kitchen with her handwriting that kind of brought me closer to her.
Along with the portions about your mom, when John is introduced, there's this palpable deep breath in your story. You know, it's like the sun comes out. And clearly his dogs approved of you very early on.
Oh, no. Why did you have to bring that up?
Well, because I think it says a lot that they moved over, at least to let you have some part of the bed.
And to leave their hairs all over me, yes.
It's in their job description. Do you have the book with you?
I do.
Would you read on page 160.
Sure. Yes, John, my husband, has been my mensch in shining armor, and I have a chapter about how I decided to tell him I loved him before he ever told me, which was quite a challenge for an approval junkie who desperately wanted to hear it first. So I finally told him I loved him, and he told me he loved me. I inched closer to him on his sofa to hold his hand. It was quiet and rainy. It wasn't a huge, dramatic, or passionate moment. What it was true, mutual, effortless, safe, all hallmarks of our relationship then and now. Okay, maybe our marriage is occasionally effortful, like when we get into it, because I don't understand why John has to sneeze so loudly that I'm sure he'll wake our children, and he says he can't help it. And I say, what would you do if you were hiding from a murderer and you had to sneeze? You would obviously stifle it. So would you please pretend there's a psychopathic killer in the house next time? Or I ask him if he will feed a child lunch, and he says, sure. And 5 minutes later, he's still looking at pipes on eBay. And I decide that our different notions of time are keeping me from being able to lean in. So I harumph that, fine, I'll do it myself. These episodes don't always go well. Oh, and also, he interrupts me all the time because he says he just wants to get to the bottom line. But mostly, like the moment we said, I love you, to each other. Our relationship is gentle.
Thank you. I just love that.
Thank you.
I think our audience would especially appreciate hearing you talk about what you describe as living the public radio dream.
Oh, the glamour of public radio. Public radio saved my life, and that is not too dramatic to say. I grew up acting when I was a kid in Atlanta. I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I did a Six Flags Over Georgia commercial.
Whoa.
And one of the first times I got a big paycheck, and it was big to a 13-year-old. I did a Chick-fil-A industrial. Of course, we did not film on Sunday. So I grew up doing theater and did theater in college, did theater in grad school, left grad school in England, moved to L.A., had some success. I got beamed up on Star Trek. I got to wear gold lame on Sex and the City, but not the kind of success I had hoped for. And again, as an approval junkie, you know, coming from, well, if you study hard and make straight A's, you are successful as a student, but that doesn't work in real life, right? I got to Hollywood and it didn't matter if I was a good student or thin. There's always somebody thinner or prettier or funnier or younger than you. And plus, I was living out there without a mother to feed me, you know, relentless support. So it was a very tough time. And I started doing stand-up comedy, which I was just okay at. But I found a lot of fulfillment in scripting myself. And I started doing improv comedy. And I did an improv series on Bravo called Significant Others. And I realized, oh, maybe this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Maybe I'm not supposed to be trying to read other lines that people have written for me. And truly, out of the blue, a friend from college, an old friend from college, emailed me saying, I'm putting together a new public radio show in New York and we're looking for hosts. Do you have anybody you might suggest? And I was not happy in my marriage and I was not happy in LA. And I kind of, you know, the famous story about Dick Cheney, he was supposed to find vice presidential candidates for George Bush and he became the vice president. So I Dick Cheney'd myself in there. And within months, I moved to New York to host a public radio show on Public Radio International. I had never done this before. And my learning curve was steep, but I got to take the spotlight off me and ask people questions. I got to do what you do, Lois. And you will probably agree with me. It's how lucky are we? I mean, you get to be professionally nosy, right?
Yes.
I learned about truly listening and not just asking questions because your questions are funny and you want to sound glib or chummy, but really, I mean, my entry into public radio took everything I had ever valued or I think was good at and turned it into a career. So I love listening. I love asking questions. I love doing research and reading about people or seeing amazing films. I love improvisation. And of course, everyone knows the key to good improvisation is listening and saying yes. And taking the spotlight off of myself, which I had been trying to do for decades, and turning it onto somebody else was the breakthrough. That was what was so life-changing. I thought, this feels good. It feels so much better to help other people tell their stories than to try to get attention.
And yet, it's the ultimate tribute to the interviewer if the interviewee shines.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about the life lessons you've learned from being on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, for such a fun show, it has some nice sort of, it has some good lessons. You know, when I was a fan before I was ever on it, like so many millions of people are, and I was very nervous. And Peter Sagal called me personally. I was walking through Central Park, I remember, and he was sort of giving me a pep talk. And it was just so amazing to hear Peter Sagal's voice in my ear, you know, talking to just me so warmly. And he said, you know, we'll cover you. Say whatever comes into your mind. And if it's awful or dumb, we're going to edit it out anyway. And of course, what people always say, just have a good time. And he was right. But it's, you know, it still was like, I felt like for the first year I was on it, and now I've been on the show almost 7 years, every show I was on was like an audition. And I still do prepare a lot because I really do like to cram on the news. But I would just I would just, you know, read every single headline, write everything down. I would work all week on whatever news headlines were, you know, crossing my eyes at the bottom of a TV screen. And what I learned was that, you know, a lot of times people can sniff out pre-prepared jokes. Listeners can, or worse, your fellow comedians on the panel. And so I have been called out several times for preparing a joke way in advance and shoving it in at the top of the show. And you know, comedians don't take kindly to that. They think they think, like, come on, that's, you know, you're showing the strings, as we say, you know, because the height of funny is being spontaneous, right?
Or making it seem that way.
That's exactly right. I think that there are certain panelists who are just so masterful at having come up with something before and making it seem like it comes off the top of their heads. In fact, I'm not saying that Mo Rocca does this, but what Mo does do, which has also been, I think, very, very, I've borrowed from this. It's very brave of him. Is he thinks out loud? If you think about it.
Chance to compete in what skill?
It's not going to be music because that's too believable.
It's kind of musical. It's the music that comes from the magic beans.
Oh, they're going to, the coffee? Oh, no. Oh, coffee, magic beans? Is that
beans,
a drug thing?
Beans,
the
magical fruit.
The more you eat,
the more you
poop.
Part of Mo's, you know, particular strain of humor is this stream of consciousness of answering a question. Instead of pausing to come up with the answer in his head, which we most of us do, right, because we don't want to sound silly or dumb or get it wrong, Mo just kind of puts it all out there. And it's very brave and generous to let people hear, you know, the thoughts that are running through your head. So I've learned, you know, from being on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I've learned to prepare a little, but to trust myself to be funny in the moment. I've learned also that you don't have to be the funniest. I mean, the people on the show, Paula Poundstone, just comic geniuses. And sometimes it's enough that I'm there to just kind of make an assist, to kind of set up a joke. Mike Pesca, who is occasionally a guest host, told me recently that he actually talked to the producers of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me about people's roles on the show and that I'm considered a facilitator.
Oh, my.
I will take that role. You know, I'm the geeky one who's maybe done a little bit extra research, so I might throw in some fact or some piece of trivia that other people can riff off of. And finally, making a mistake, like saying something so dumb or so wrong, can lead to the most, I mean, we all know this, right? If you're brave enough to screw up, sometimes those lead to the funniest moments, like the Batman's nipples comment that I talk about in the book. They were doing the Not My Job for Mark Bittman, the famous, you know, chef. I guess he's a food writer.
Yeah, the minimalist.
Yes. So for Mark Bittman, they decided to ask him questions about Batman. And I immediately, I know nothing about Batman. I immediately said, oh, are you going to talk about Batman's nipples?
Of all the modern Batman films.
Is that the one where Batman had nipples?
That is the one.
That answers the first question.
I am never inviting you back, Faith. Answer.
Of course, that was one of the questions, and Peter was so mad at me, and yet they kept that in the show.
Or C, nipples on the bat suits.
Guess I'll take a flyer with C.
You would be correct. Don't know how you could have known that, but yes.
In the end, you offer a future explanation to your daughter about how seeking approval has not undone you.
Yeah, I say that it has done me. I mean, it's dinged me. I certainly have my scars, but even my most painful experiences with seeking approval, for example, in my first marriage, which was incredibly difficult for me, and I'm sure for him, it has led me to be oh so grateful for her father and for my second marriage and for the second chance at life and happiness. My experiences being disappointed as an actor have made me again, so grateful and so acutely conscious of how lucky I am to get to do what I love for a living and to have some agency over what I do, to be able to express myself in ways that I want to rather than rely on people to cast me. I hope my daughter seeks, I hope both my children seek approval. I hope they seek approval from people who have earned it, from people who have their best interests in mind. And I hope they seek my approval. I think that's a developmental milestone. I'm very proud of them when they eat their vegetables or say thank you. But I hope, most of all, that they seek their own approval. It's the root of the word approval, right? Just to continue to try to prove things to yourself.